This is Imperfectly Polished with Monique Bondi. It's styled, not staged.
It's Wednesday, the 15th of July. It's just past 2 o'clock. Welcome back, besties, and welcome to Imperfectly Polished, the space where we celebrate confidence, wellness, self-care, and the beautifully messy journey of being human. There are some conversations we avoid because they're uncomfortable. We whisper about them. We hide them behind closed doors. We hope that they fix themselves. Addiction is one of those conversations. It doesn't just affect the person struggling with substance abuse. It changes entire families. It reshapes relationship. It tests love, patience, and hope in ways few can experience. If you've ever loved someone battling addiction, you'll know the emotional roller coaster all too well. One day you're hopeful, the next you're heartbroken. You celebrate small victories, only to find yourself picking up the pieces after another setback. But today's conversation isn't just about addiction. It's about recovery, it's about forgiveness, it's about rebuilding trust, and perhaps most importantly, it's about hope. Joining us today are two people who lived the same story from very different perspectives. Anne Lapidus-Brest is the author of the powerful new memoir, 18 Years an Addict, A Mother's Journey from Despair to Hope, a deeply honest account of what it's like to love a son caught in addiction for nearly two decades. Joining her is that son, Greg Brest. Today, Greg celebrates more than 7 years in recovery, and together they're sharing not just the pain of those 18 years, but the healing, what the healing has looked like on the other side. Anne and Greg, welcome to my show, Imperfectly Polished.
Thank you.
Thank you, Monique.
So I love the idea of always making this a little playful before we get into a heavier conversation. So Anne, this is for you. You are a photographer, writer, and genealogist. Which of those roles describes you the best?
Photographer.
Is that it? You like to capture people?
Well, you know, writing and photography are very similar because you are expressing yourself. So I express myself when I write. It's like through the lens of the camera. So I think that photography and writing are very similar in a lot of ways.
What's one thing that's always in your handbag that says something about who you are?
My cell phone.
If your camera could tell the story of your life, what moment would it never delete?
That's a very difficult question to answer. What moment would it never delete? Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm going to say contentment and happiness and fulfillment.
That's a good answer. Thank you. Greg, on to you. Greg, we'll switch handbags for wallets. What's something that's always in your wallet or on your phone that keeps you grounded?
Life 360. Yes, the Life 360 app, which tracks me, my Clicks card, my Woolies card, and an Irish three-leaf clover from Dublin.
I love that.
For luck.
We'll be right back after the ad break.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
We're back with chatting to Angela. Anne and Greg. Greg, 7 years into recovery, what's something that brings you joy today that addiction robbed you of so many years?
Definitely the quality time with my parents and my family, being fully present in the moment and just having so much gratitude for every day.
If people met you today without knowing your story, Greg, what would surprise them most about you?
If people met me today without knowing my story, how disciplined I am, how focused I am, it's all about keeping things simple.
Totally.
So, you know, just family time, working hard, going to the gym, eating well, and that's pretty much it. No, just, and obviously putting my recovery first, you know what I mean? That obviously comes number one, but just how focused I am and how disciplined I am.
For both of you, what's the one thing the two of you enjoy doing together today that wasn't possible during those 18 years?
Well, I'll go first on this one. We're very close. Mm-hmm. There's no secrets. Total transparency. Whereas during the 18 years, I was always kind of tiptoeing around Greg. Didn't want to upset him, afraid to bring up certain topics. Whereas today, that's all gone. We're just like, you know, two friends and we talk. It doesn't matter what it's about. So I'm enjoying that.
That must be so refreshing to know that there's absolutely no secrets, nothing to hide. Because often, you know, parents and children don't have those sort of relationships.
Well, today we're very close. We'll talk about anything. Of course, you know, there is nothing. But there was things to hide and it was not an easy time.
So I did read your book in preparation for today's show, and it brought up so many emotions for me reading it. There were in some parts, I just wanted to tell you, Anne, that why aren't you just accepting what is in front of you and eventually put Greg into rehab without waiting for the moment that he comes to his own conclusions to get clean?
Okay, I'm going to answer that in two ways. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's very difficult to just put a child into rehab. Mm-hmm. Oh, you can physically drive him there, but the chances are that he's going to run away. Mm-hmm. And Greg used to say, if I put him into rehab, he's going to run away and I won't see him again.
Mm, I remember
but
reading that.
But the other reason, sorry, just repeat the question. Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
It's very hard to accept something, even if that thing is staring you in the face. It's very, very difficult. You have a child, a little baby, and he grows up. He's cute, you know, you adore him. And when somebody says he's using, you think there must be some mistake.
Mm.
You know, there must be another explanation, even though it was obvious to me. I couldn't accept it. And believe you me, I was fed up with myself over...
I hope you don't mind me asking you that question.
Not at all. You can ask me anything.
So reading your book, you mentioned that Greg was the all-Jewish boy, went to King David. He was good. He was a good kid, high-spirited, funny, clever, charming. You even called him your little prince.
Yeah.
And the golden boy I read in there. So there are two names for him. So when this happened, how did you reconcile it in your head?
Well, are you saying that maybe I wouldn't think he...
You know, yes, you wouldn't...
No.
Yeah.
You know, a mother's love for a child knows no bounds. And it doesn't matter what they do. You don't love them any less. He always used to say... You know, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm sure you're not proud of me. And I say, no, Gregory, I am proud of you. You're always, not of what he was doing, but as my son and as who he was, the person he was, is always proud. And the fact that he was using did not make me think any less of him.
Greg, a question for you. Looking back, when do you think the addiction really began?
I would say the addiction most likely began in London, when I went to London for 2 years after university. That's when I was first introduced to drugs.
And just, it was just at a club?
Yeah. Starts off
relaxing,
as
chilling.
Yeah, starts off as fun. Once a month, once every 2 weeks, once a week, you know, twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of... progresses. So that's when it started for me in London after university, yeah.
Anne, what emotions defined those 18 years for you?
Well, I was very upset, you know.
And it comes across in the book very well, your emotions.
I was very upset. And I didn't know what to do. I was bewildered. I also didn't know if I was going with sugar or if these things were really happening. I didn't know whether I was just taking it too far, maybe being a bit neurotic, a bit ridiculous, or whether I should be waking up and looking at the problem.
But I think, Greg, you did a very good job from what was said in the book of to cover it up.
Yeah.
Very manipulative. Very, very good at, you know, playing the game.
Mm.
So, you know, and it's also not necessarily, you think you are going with sugar because it's not, it is in front of your face, but it's not because the person is trying to pull the wool over your eyes.
Well, I think also that when I did ask occasionally, mm-hmm. I couldn't help myself, and, you know, he was very exuberant and shouting,
yes.
and you know, what is he using? And I asked him once, was he using? But I could see on my first trip to America mm-hmm. and in England that he was using so much. But when he'd say, no, Mom, and then I think, oh, thank God. And I didn't want to push it further because I wanted to believe
yes.
that.
Like every other mother would want to.
Because I didn't want to know. And if he is using, what am I going to do?
Greg, when you were in active addiction, did you understand what your family was going through, or was it just all about you and your next fix?
Okay, so I was living in London mm-hmm. for 2 years, and then I moved to LA
yes.
for 13 years.
To be a part in the bold and the beautiful.
Exactly, and the young and the restless.
Yes.
Yeah.
Loved.
So I was overseas a lot of the time, mm-hmm. so it's like I was so far away.
Removed.
Exactly. They didn't always know what I was getting up to, so I knew I wasn't really hurting anyone, and no one knew anything. So I could get away with a lot of the things. You know, I mean, I was arrested twice for drunk driving,
yes.
6 weeks apart. Mm-hmm. They didn't know because I was in and out of jail within 48 hours.
But didn't you have family there? Weren't there close family of yours there that you tried to have them monitor, Greg?
Brian Marcus, our first cousin, he lives in Redlands, lived in Redlands, which is about 2 hours mm-hmm. from
LA.
And they used to go cycling together mm. and have fun together, and we'd meet on the beach together. But Brian didn't really twig. Greg just didn't show that side. So basically, he was getting away with it, but there were certain signs. I mean, I can't go into each and every one, but I knew, I'm very intuitive, and I knew this is not the boy I raised. He was so different. You know, his attitude, and he was...
I mean, he was downright rude to you.
Yeah, he's screaming at me. Something. I felt desperate. You asked me earlier mm-hmm. how I felt. Desperate is one of the words. I didn't know where to turn. And I did turn to Gay Turiel. Mm. She ran a home.
I actually know her. I knew her. Yeah, of course.
And I went to her support groups. I went both times to her, and she was amazing. A lovely soft voice, and she just made me feel a lot better. But the feeling, you know, when you go home, Gay's not living
yes.
with me. Gay's in her home.
And it's reality now.
Yeah,
Gay.
And then everything that she said just goes out of my head. I was desperate.
We will be right back after the ad break.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Also, I'd like to invite our listeners to comment, or if you have a question for Greg or Anne, please WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. And there is a chance for a listener to win a copy, a signed copy of Anne's book, which I recommend for everyone to read. I finished it in 2 days. It was an easy read the way you wrote. Wasn't an easy story to unpack, but you wrote it beautifully.
Thank you.
So for both of you, addiction thrives in silence. Why do you think families are still afraid to talk about it?
Well, for myself, I wasn't afraid to talk about it at all. I found that my friends were sympathetic, but they didn't understand mm-hmm. because you cannot understand, and they couldn't understand me. You know, I remember a late friend of mine said to me, but Anne, it's staring you in the face, and I couldn't accept it.
Did you get cross when people said that to you?
No, because I knew they were coming from
a good place.
Yes, and they had my interests at heart, but I made excuses all the time for him, but I was never ashamed, and I think a lot of people are ashamed to admit that their child or loved one mm-hmm. is an addict. I don't find any shame in addiction. I found the shame in denial, and that was Rabbi Twersky said that. It's not my own words of
yes.
wisdom. But no, I was not afraid to talk about it. But at the same time, you know, you can't walk around being a photographer, I've got to be happy and smile. I can't ruin people's simchas because I've got a problem at home. So I didn't talk about it a lot. But if people asked me, I was quite happy to explain.
Direct.
Yeah. I hope that answers the question.
No, it definitely does. Greg, so I want to go back to the time you were in LA and you had this hope for yourself that you would make it in La La Land.
Mm-hmm.
The environment that you put yourself in wasn't exactly conducive to not taking drugs. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. So when I first moved to LA, I finally, after 3 months of trying, got a job working for ex-South African Jewish boys that owned nightclubs and restaurants in LA.
I just wanted to smack you on the head and say, why did you go into that?
Well, I needed a job.
Yeah.
I left with $500 and I had $10 left.
Sure.
So I needed a job. So I started off working as a barback, as a busboy, as a, you know, that's like in that field, doing some club promoting. So I was in the, you know, in the thick of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just wanted to pick you up and like throw you out of the thick of it because it was totally the wrong environment. It just actually probably fueled it.
Yeah. 100%.
Easily accessible.
Easily accessible. But I was still a functioning addict for the first, you know, 5 to 10 years. I was able to, you know, manage it, but it was definitely always around. Alcohol was certainly, I was always working in the clubs, so it definitely became an issue.
A question for you, Anne, is that was there ever a moment that you think, that you thought, I can't do this anymore, I need someone else to take control of the situation?
I would say that while the thought came fleetingly into my head, I knew that, no, I would never give it up. I would run to Gay, you know, and when this sort of thing happened, I'd phone Gay, look, I've got to see you, I've got to see you. The biggest thing for me and the biggest fear throughout the whole addiction, there were two things. One, that he would just disappear, because a lot of addicts do that. And the second thing, I was petrified that something would happen to him, either a drug overdose or he would intentionally just overdose because he couldn't take the problem anymore. That was my biggest fear. And I'm here in Joburg. He's over there. I can tell you, I didn't
many
sleep.
Sleepless nights. I was going to say, you must have had... Thanks. Greg, you gave your mother sleep. Like any other Jewish child along the way.
It was terrible, but I would run to Gay. I never just sat and suffered in silence, you know what I mean?
And the interesting part for me in the book, Greg, was that every time you returned to South Africa, you found solace and healing with going to visit your grandmother. Can you elaborate on your relationship with her?
Absolutely. So, you know, my gran and I were very, very close, just as I'm close with my mom and dad and my family. But it was definitely a period to, like, chill out. I'd come back. I'd spend 2 or 3 weeks just doing no drugs, spending time with family, trying to regroup, you know, balance myself. But my gran and I obviously were very, very close. So it was definitely just like a cathartic experience, very healing. And
but she, so for the record, she never ever was told of your drug usage. So she still did see you as her golden boy.
Absolutely. Once we were out with my brother and sister-in-law or my nieces and nephews, and Greg was behaving really peculiarly, running from the table all the time, then coming back, then running. And my mother said to Greg's grand, said to me, what's wrong with him? You know, why can't he sit still? And my brother also said, you know, what's wrong with Greg? And I couldn't say anything. I just didn't want to say anything. But the, one of the reasons why Greg and my daughter Angela and my mother were very, very close, when I first got divorced, we lived with my mother for about a year. And my mother also, she did all the lift schemes, et cetera, et cetera. So she was very much part of my children's lives. And they saw her as another mother.
I did. I found like I found the relationship fascinating, that that Greg came home and every time it was straight his grandmother. And I felt like he healed while he was here, but didn't, obviously. But especially in her company.
That's exactly right. And then when I would return back to LA, the overwhelming force to want to get high would overwhelm me.
So, but then how did you contain yourself while you were here?
Because it's like a different world to being in LA.
But if you need drugs, you need drugs.
Yeah, but it's just, you don't associate.
Fine.
It's just different because all the family's here and it's so familiar and it's where you grew up. So it's just a different world. You know, you just don't have that same crazy desire.
And can we talk about your daughter's approach to what she suggested you do for Greg when he was in active addiction? Like her reaction for me was like, he's just take him to rehab and that's it. There's no discussion, full stop, Greg needs to go to rehab. And you kind of pushed back a lot in the book about that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, sure. You see, Angela having cleaned up, mm-hmm. and you know, when a person cleans up and they're reformed, you know, I don't want to say holier than thou, but they've done the work. And they've got mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. And when they were both using together, which I didn't know about, there wasn't a word out of Angela. But when she started getting clean, she berated me that I wasn't strict enough with him.
Yeah, that's the word that I would have said. Yeah. She did berate you a lot. You butted heads quite a bit with her.
And I did find that I kind of wanted to lie to her because I couldn't bear the thought of a whole business, you know, a whole balagan.
Explosion.
So I did lie a bit. Like I didn't give her the full truth. When the very end came and mm-hmm. Greg was definitely going to clean up, and I really believed, it's a long story, mm-hmm. I can't go into it now, but I really trusted and believed, and she said, oh, Mom, you know, not again. Mm. And I said, Angela, 2 months, and she wasn't one bit happy. And then I thought, well, maybe I'm not doing the right thing. But I believed so strongly that somehow he was different and he promised. I know he's promised before, but I really believed. And he had a sponsor there as well.
Yes, we're going to get to that part as well.
And I said, please. And she said, 2 months. I said, okay, 2 months. Mm. And if he's not right after 2 months, then I will see that he goes into one of the rehabs.
I mean, I love the way you kept saying finished and clear.
Yeah.
Quite a few times in the book. Like, it's now finished and clear. Which, you know, it wasn't always so cut and dry. I want to ask our listeners to join our conversation. If you have a question or a comment for Anne or Greg, please WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. Remember, there is a signed copy of Anne's book up for grabs. So please make a comment or a question and you can be in the running to win that copy. And believe you me, it is a worthwhile read.
Thank you.
So now I want to go to January 2019.
Yeah.
That was changed your life, Greg. Mm-hmm. What happened and what made that day different from every other attempt?
So the first thing that happened was, for me, you asked earlier, mm-hmm. you know, being over, I was able to always get away with it. When I found out.
Very much so.
Yeah. When I was here and Mom found out again and everything, you know, went south. And I was also at the stage where I was ready.
You were sick and tired of being sick and tired.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I was ready. I tried for the year before to try to do it on my own, and I couldn't do it on my own. I'd get a couple of days mm-hmm. clean, then I'd relapse, then clean, relapse. A vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. When Mom finally found out, and I was ready, I didn't want to hurt anyone, obviously. You never want to hurt anyone around you.
Of course not.
So that was Mom was the main catalyst that I didn't want to upset her anymore. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, I actually got involved in a 12-step program. You know, there's five things that we have to do, and one of them is get a sponsor, and we do step work, and mm-hmm. there's five things. Mm-hmm. And I actually dived in and did all those five things for the first time. And if you do those five things, you stay clean and sober.
So you promised your family, Greg, no more lies, no more secrets. Why was the honesty the first step for you?
Well, it's a program of mm-hmm. honesty, first of all, so you have to be honest. So are you asking why?
So I'm just saying, like, why was finally acknowledging your problem possibly more to yourself than anyone else. Why was that 2019 different from every other time? Please.
I'm going to answer.
Please, Baden.
I know that the first step towards cleaning up is for an addict to admit to himself, hello, my name is Greg, I am an addict. And that honesty he had for the first time in 18 years when we sat with Cals, who's the sponsor, and he said, Mom, I have been using, I'm going to be transparent. It's all in the book, so I won't repeat. And that was the first time that Greg had actually ever owned up and said in such a strong voice, and he was humbled. He wasn't arrogant and shouting and screaming. He was quietly spoken and humbled, and he said, I am going to clean up and I'm going to have total transparency. You can phone Kells anytime and ask him. And that's exactly what I felt was he was ready.
You saw something beyond that moment in 2019.
Yes.
So, Greg, just for the listeners out of interest, can you describe your drugs of choice?
Sure. So
if you don't mind.
Not at all. In London, it was alcohol, it was ecstasy, and cocaine.
Expensive habits
Very.
In London.
Oh, absolutely. I spent
but
all the money.
But you did have
I
a
made.
Good job.
I had a great job.
You did have a good job.
But I spent all the money and more than I'd made, right? I left in debt. And then in LA, alcohol and cocaine, for sure. And then when I got back to South Africa, I couldn't find good coke, so I started doing cat, an awful drug called cat. Yeah.
So recovery isn't just about stopping the drugs, Greg. What was the hardest habit or mindset you had to change?
No, so recovery is about not just putting down the drugs and the alcohol. Mm. It's about working on yourself and trying to become a better person, living a spiritual life with honesty and trying to be a good person, right? It's about your behavior. So the hardest thing that I had to change was, well, you know, at first, obviously, you miss the... It's that cycle that you have to break of the habit of doing the drugs. And what recovery does is it teaches you, it taught me to go within and try and figure out what am I afraid to deal with that I can't, that I need an escape. So it's learning to love and accept yourself. That's a process, which we have the 12 steps for. But it's about going within and healing what's within. And becoming and accepting and loving yourself as opposed to looking for something outside of yourself to try and fill the void, which it never does.
So in the book, if I can be transparent, and you and Greg's father, Jaime, divorced when he was pretty young. And you get the sense from the book that Greg was highly affected by his absence and not being around. Do you think that could have been a contributing factor?
I'm answering again. Can I answer?
Yeah, sure.
You know, right through the divorce, and Jaime did marry again and had more children, I thought that I was lucky. Mm-hmm. And I said to people, I'm so lucky. My kids are not at all affected
by the
divorce. They've
unscathed by it,
yes.
Yeah.
That's what I believed. Mm-hmm. But when Greg and I were in Ireland once, he almost verbally attacked me for divorcing Jaime. And he said, but Mom, why? And I said, but you know why? No, I want to know. I want to hear it again. He said, you were selfish, Mom. Mm-hmm. And he was loud. And we were supposed to go for supper. We never went. I was in a state crying and everything. But I realized then that the divorce had affected him. He didn't grow up with the mother and father. Listen, lots of children
I'm from a divorced family.
Well, there
myself.
You are. But not every child from a divorce. You know, every different strokes for different folks. And as I say, while I thought it had, he never showed any signs, neither did Angela. But maybe when Greg was using, and maybe he did resent me, in some way for divorcing his father because he brought it up.
Yes.
You know?
I did think maybe, I mean, I'm no psychologist either, so please no one take my observation as the truth. I also thought maybe there could have been some correlation because it was mentioned and how it did affect him growing up. Greg, what role has your sponsor played in your recovery? Can we talk about him?
Sure, a very big one. So a sponsor is somebody that has at least a year of clean time, being clean and sober, that has walked through the 12 steps, done them all, and basically takes you through the 12 steps. And he was a crucial element of it because he was very gentle with me.
Yes, I was going to say, it can't just be, you have to, you actually have to
connect
with the person.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, too hard.
Yes, and I promised myself that I would be open and honest, like with a therapist, you know, what's the point in lying to him? Otherwise, I won't get better. And I really wanted to get better. So I promised that I would be open and honest with him, but he was very gentle. He didn't say you have to, you know, it's advised that you do 90 meetings in 90 days. He didn't say you have to do that. He said try to do 5 meetings a week. He didn't say you have to check in with me.
Otherwise, it's not sustainable.
Correct. And at first, when you're first, you know, coming into the program, it's advised that you do 90 meetings in 90 days. But he wasn't authoritarian. He was very gentle and very kind because I wouldn't have responded to somebody that was...
Hold that thought, Greg. We'll be right back.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
It is 3:15. You're listening to Imperfectly Polished, and we are still talking to Greg and Anne. So, Greg, we were talking about your sponsor and what role he played in your recovery. Does he still play a role?
Absolutely. It's a lifelong connection. And, you know, it's somebody that has turned their lives around and you want what they have and they guide you and you can be completely open and honest with them and tell them everything because chances are they've done the same things too. So they don't judge you and they don't look down on you. They've done all the same things. So it's a very strong bond that you have with your sponsor and he'll be in my life forever.
And are you a sponsor to anyone?
So I was, and I'm supposed to be. I'm not at the moment, just because I'm so busy with, you know, work.
It's a commitment.
It is a commitment.
In and of itself.
You know, it's very important because it keeps me close to the program and it keeps me connected to recovery, so I should. And I probably
should. In the right time, I'm sure you will again.
Yeah.
And as a mother, was it difficult when Greg finally had the conversation with you to believe him, and when did you finally allow yourself to grieve?
Well, I didn't grieve, I have to be honest. I was a little bit nervous, but what he said to me, I accepted and I believed him right away. But to believe in him, for example, you know, it's a common fact that addicts steal from their parents. So for a while, I kept my purse, you know, well away from him. But then after a while, you realize he's not going to steal. And bit by bit, it doesn't happen overnight. But I didn't find it difficult to believe him. I believed him implicitly when he told me that he was cleaning up. And I knew he was with Cal's, the sponsor. And I felt confident. Listen, you know, there were times I would wake up and think, oh, God, I hope he's going to his meeting. But
no,
I
he did skip a few in the book. He did pretend he was going
Before he cleaned up. Once he cleaned up, he went. But I would lie awake and I'd hear his door open and I'd hear him going into the bathroom, coming and going. And I thought, oh, thank goodness. I don't think like that anymore. But for the first maybe 6-8 months, because it was crucial, my nerves were shot. But
I'm
you start to relax.
Trust.
And I don't think about it anymore. I don't see him anymore. It's only when I wrote the book and because I'm doing all the talks. But you don't forget it. And you don't become blasé. Eternally grateful. I am grateful. All the time I'm grateful. But you don't focus on it anymore because he's now, to me, not Greg, you know, he's just recovering. He's just Greg, my son, and he's a good businessman and a good father. A good son.
One day. He is single, ladies. I had to throw that in.
Freudian slip. He's a good son to his father and to me. And he's just a good person all around. And I just get a lot of nachas from that. So I'm in a very as I said, I'm very content, I'm happy, and I feel very fulfilled with both my children.
And so if you had to say anything on air now to parents who are facing a similar situation, maybe still in a little bit of denial, how you were, what advice would you give to them?
Well, I would like to say to the listeners that years ago I was photographing Adele Searle, and I was listening, and I thought, oh, this is never going to apply to me. You know, my kids are not in
famous
that.
Last words. Yeah. It'll never happen to me.
And I just want to say that please don't think for one moment that it cannot happen to you. And I see lovely girls with lovely children. They come to the shul, they go to other shuls. And I think that's how Greg was once, a lovely little boy. These parents love their children to the moon and back. But don't think for one moment that you're exempt, because it happens to everybody, black, white, rich, poor,
doesn't
famous and non-famous. You know, it just happens out of the blue. And I wasn't prepared, and you're probably not prepared. And I would appreciate if people would ask me. Nobody's ever asked me questions from people. I haven't had questions from people that I expect to have questions.
That's
from.
Interesting. But are you available or approachable in any which way for parents that would want to reach out for you? Is that something that you'd be open to? Is something
yes.
that you do?
Yes, I do. And I've been on shows before, and people have phoned me, and I've tried to help, or I don't tell them what to do. I tell them what I did, because obviously I can only talk from my own perspective.
And we are going to go to an ad break. We'll be right back.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back. Today's conversation has reminded us that while addiction can divide families, honesty, support, and recovery have the power to rebuild them. Before we let Anne and Greg go, let's answer some of the questions many listeners may be asking themselves. Greg, if someone is listening and battling addiction today but feels they're beyond saving, what would you say to them?
They are not beyond saving. My recommendation would be to go to a meeting, to go online, look for either an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting or Narcotics Anonymous meeting or Gamblers Anonymous or whatever it is, but go online and look for the closest meeting and go to a meeting. And there you will meet people that are going through the same things that you're going through, that have dealt with it, that will welcome you in, and it all starts from there, but go to a meeting.
Do you ever stop calling yourself an addict, Greg?
No. I'm always an addict. And it's one day at a time, you know, that I try and do the right thing and try to be a good person and try to live by spiritual principles, but I'm always an addict.
To both of you, looking back now, is there a conversation that either of you wished you had had years earlier?
I can't honestly say that there, you know, hindsight is always easy, Monique. But I cannot think of anything that I wished I had said or that I had done anything different. Because even if I did recognize this shocking behavior, and I did recognize it at times, there was nothing I could have done. So I believe...
You really did. It comes across in the book.
Thank you.
You really believe that it would come from Greg.
Yeah, that's what I waited for, that, and it eventually happened. And Angela is very proud of him. We all are. But Angela is very proud of her brother. And I think that maybe he would have cleaned up a few years quicker, but he didn't. And I'm fine with that. I have no regrets.
That's lovely. I love that, for you to say that as a mother, you have no regrets. No. What do you hope readers will carry with them after reading your book? Anne?
Well, I hope the readers who sometimes feel that there's something not quite right with their son or daughter or husband, whoever, that they will wake up and think, you know, that's what Anne was talking about. That's what she was referring to. And yes, I am available for questions, very available. because if I can help somebody, I'm only too happy. So,
the do you have an email address that
yes,
people could email?
Yes.
Do you want to say, give it?
Yes.
Do you mind?
It's not at all. Digital photo. It's one word, all small. DigitalPhoto at icon.co.za. And anybody is certainly welcome. But I want you let people know that there is hope and not to give up hope. And I personally didn't believe in tough love. I couldn't do it. It doesn't. I couldn't. And I don't regret not doing it. But if you feel that there is something off with your child, then there probably
the mother's,
is.
Your mother's instinct and gut is generally always right,
yes,
I think.
Yes, yes.
So the book is called 18 Years and an Addict, A Mother's Journey from Despair to Hope. But sitting here today together, I wonder if the title could have another ending. If you had to describe this chapter of your lives in just one word, what would it be?
Oh, your questions are so difficult sometimes.
I'm trying my best.
Just repeat that. If
so
I could.
Sitting here today, I wonder if the title could have had another ending. What would it be? And how would you describe the chapter of your lives now in one word?
Well, as I said, happy.
The happy ending.
The happy ending. Mm. And no, I wouldn't change the title, but yes, the title underneath, it does say A Mother's Journey from Despair to Hope, right? So that's it.
And always live with the hope, Anne, that
you have to
tell people that they can't give up that hope for anyone in any situation at the moment, whether it be mental health, dealing with drugs, dealing with other addictions, that there's you must keep that little glimmer of hope.
Well, it's the hope that kept me going. I am an anxious person. You know, people say, oh, you're so strong. I'm not.
Most Jews are anxious.
I'm anxious and I'm neurotic and, you know. But I had this firm belief and I had to hang on to the hope. And it worked. It thank God it paid off.
Anne and Greg, thank you both for your honesty, your courage, and your willingness to share such a deeply personal part of your lives with us. Today's conversation has reminded us that addiction doesn't affect one person, it touches everyone who loves them. It brings heartbreak, uncertainty, and moments when hope feels impossible to hold on to. But we've also heard something equally important, that recovery is possible, it may not be easy, it may not be quick, and certainly not without setbacks, but it's possible. Greg, thanks for reminding us that no matter how long someone has struggled, change can begin with one decision, one honest conversation, and the willingness to ask for help. Anne, thank you for giving a voice to the parents, siblings, and loved ones who often suffer in silence. Your story reminds us that while we cannot force someone into recovery, we can continue to choose compassion, healthy boundaries, and hope. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Imperfectly Polished. Until next time, take care of yourselves, be kind to one another, and remember that healing doesn't just happen overnight, but every journey begins with hope, and life isn't about being perfect, it's about being beautifully, imperfectly polished.